Hey sleepers, before we get started, I just wanted to tell you about our new sponsor, Pristine Auctions. Pristine Auctions is a great place to get signed jerseys, signed helmets, signed footballs, all that stuff. What's great about it is not only are they cheaper than there, but they're also signed. We actually got a signed Antonio Brown jersey that we are giving away to one of our listeners. One of you is going to win a signed Antonio Brown jersey from Pristine Auctions. All you have to do is go on iTunes, give us a review, and let us know what your username is there. You'll be entered in to win an Antonio Brown signed jersey, courtesy of Pristine Auctions, P-R-I-S-T-I-N-E. If you head over there, let them know Sleeper Wire sent you. Now, play along with this one.
This is a show about how to control your opponent's choices. If you play along, I promise, by the end, will amaze you. Now, you may think you've heard some of these things before, but you never heard it like this. Pay attention. I got an experiment for you two that I kind of want to try out. Are you guys game for this?
Game.
All right, here we go. I want you to think of a number in your head from 1 to 5.
Got it.
I want you to multiply that number by 9. If that number is a 2-digit number, add those digits together. If it's a 1-digit number, leave it as it is. Now, subtract 5. This is your final number. Got it?
Yep.
Determine which letter of the alphabet corresponds to the number you ended up with. For example, 1 is A, 2 is B, 3 is C, etc. Quickly, think of a country that starts with that letter. Now, remember the last letter of the name of that country. Now, think of an animal that starts with that letter. Remember the last letter in the name of that animal. Finally, think of a name of a fruit that starts with that letter. I hate to tell you guys, there are no orange kangaroos in Denmark. But there are ways to control your opponent's choices. You guys ready to start this show?
Let's do it.
Welcome, sleepers. It's Adam and Chris, and we have a special episode with a special guest here for you today. My guest, neuroscience PhD candidate from the University of Pennsylvania, Ian McLaughlin. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Ian.
Well, as you said, I'm a PhD candidate at UPenn, and I study anxiety and addiction. And in particular, it's the neuronal circuitry or the neurophysiology of anxiety and addiction and mood in general.
Very, very cool. And so I've read some things about you. You're an expert in immunohistochemistry and chemogenetics, as well as confocal microscopy, is that correct?
Yeah, so those are just a bunch of jargon for I can take pretty pictures of the brain. And I can use genetics and designer receptors to control the activities of circuits.
Well, I actually, we were talking before this, and while we were talking, I was telling him how excited I was to have him on the show. And I asked you, I said, how smart are you? And I want to play a real quick clip of that. So if you just give me 1 second. Let me play this.
Yeah, that's smart. Let me put it this way. Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates? Yes. Morons. Red.
Morons, huh, Ian?
Definitely. Yeah, no. I promise everybody that's listening that I am no smarter than any of you. I promise you.
So, neuroscientist, that's like gynecologist, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You got it. Awesome. Podcast over.
What is neuroscience, just so our listeners know?
Sure. So basically neuroscience is the science of the brain or the nervous system. The nervous system, of course, encompasses more than just the brain, but most of the research in neuroscience focuses on the brain. And it's a multidisciplinary discipline or science in that it involves biology, physics, pharmacology, or, you know, the action of drugs, a little bit of engineering even. And then, of course, psychology, because what we're most interested in is how consciousness is encoded by the brain.
Oh, so that is behavioral neuroscience.
So behavioral neuroscience, I mean, it's impossible for any one scientist to be able to operate on all levels of the relationships between the matter, the physical stuff of the brain, and human behavior. It's impossible to just be able to do it all. So we tend to focus on certain domains of the nervous system. And so, for example, I focus on circuits, like networks of neurons or brain cells that are communicating with other networks of neurons. But then other neuroscientists might focus specifically on behavior in humans, like, you know, decision making or memory in humans. And so there's just a lot of work to do. And so we got to break it up.
Awesome. And I'm sorry, Chris, I'm pretty excited, obviously, about our guest. But Chris, our professor, statistician, is here with us as well. Chris, how you doing?
Doing pretty well, man. For the record, it's statistician. But I'm sure you mispronounced a whole lot of things that Ian does, so it's no surprise that you mispronounced that.
But Chris, you know what's funny is popped into my mind. So it turns out that people used to pronounce skeletal. Like there was a period of time where like academics would say skeletal to just, I guess, try and make their own way in academia. So you can get away with saying microscopy, I suppose.
Well, the goal of today's show is not about my pronunciation. The goal of the show is today to talk about reading our opponent's mind. But not only that, we're going to talk about how you can manipulate your opponents into giving you what you want. And by the end of this show, I'm going to teach you a technique. I've used it myself, and it does work. So if you keep listening, by the end of the show, you'll learn these techniques. One thing I wanted to kind of talk to you guys about that I think has to do with this show is the show Westworld. You guys ever seen it? You guys fans?
I am.
I still need to watch. Sorry, go ahead, Greg.
No, I'm three episodes in, and I do really like it so far.
I've heard it's one of the coolest shows of all time, and I literally have not seen a moment of that show. Like, my parents are, like, yelling at me to watch that show.
Well, I don't think I'm giving anything away by talking about how it's about androids and people, right? AI and people. And the androids have no free will over their choices, right? They're androids. They're robots. We tell our computer to do something, it does something. How similar are we to these androids? How much control do we have as people over our choices? Ian?
That's a huge topic, and it's definitely one that I encounter pretty regularly. And the trouble with this topic is that if you talk to five different people about what they think free will even is, you'll get five different answers or more. It's one of those things where we all kind of think that we understand exactly what we're saying to each other. But when you get right down to it, we tend to have different perspectives. Some people have a very spiritual perspective. Some people have a very sort of, you know, rudimentary or mechanistic perspective. So if you mean free will, like, does free will mean that there is or is not a sort of overarching power that's controlling your behavior? Or do you mean that it's anything that you can do when somebody doesn't have a gun to your head telling you what to do? But regardless, just the concept of free will, once you start to study the sort of circuitry of the brain, it starts to kind of become an absurd concept. The relationship between the subconscious aspects of the brain with which you really have no control over, right? You can't really intervene in the activities of these parts of the brain. Once you start to understand the relationships between that part of the brain and the parts of the brain that are associated with consciousness or conscious awareness, you kind of realize that the thing you call you is sort of the byproduct of the activity of this subconscious. And again, you have no control over that activity. And so it's kind of difficult to find a place where free will might exist.
That's great. That is basically what we're going to talk about. I mean, we are doing a show on behavioral science, but not only that, behavioral science in the context of fantasy football. Now, Chris, you're an expert at fantasy football. Have you ever made any moves, done any tricks in order to get ahead on any of your opponents?
The place that that's worked for me is when I'm having a live draft, you know, with, you know, a bunch of friends. We're all sitting around, we're having some beers, you know, we're drafting online, but we're still hanging out in person. And then just sort of talking, you know, a player that I like, saying a whole bunch of negative things about him. You know, trying to get them to think, oh, this guy isn't nearly as good. And then I'll swoop in and take him.
Yep. And that's certainly something we're going to talk about. Now, if you guys will give me just a few minutes, in Sleeper Wire, what happened? I knew I could be a better champion than I already was in fantasy football. Now, here's the thing. While I was playing, I realized that I was good at something, but I realized I wasn't good at a lot. So what Sleeper Wire is, it's a group of over a dozen multi-time, multi-league, multi-year champions from all over. This is just numbers. And we're not one, two, or three guys. We are 12 hardcore players that play basically year-around and talk about it year-around because we want to win. And here's the thing. In Sleeper Wire, we all have championships for different reasons. I mean, we play this game to win, and that is exactly what we do. Let me kind of break this down for you guys. Chris, our professor and certified genius, plays the game using, and he does because this is the way his brain works, he uses the math and the analytics in order to get ahead. At least, and I'm not saying you're not good at the other aspects. What I'm saying is that certainly controls the way you play because you're good at that aspect.
Yeah, when you play like me, you don't have to worry about the other aspects of the game. So, I mean, you don't win 4 out of 10 leagues, you know, doing something wrong.
All right, so and then we got Hoos. I mean, he's a prophet. He has intuition like crazy, right? He was talking about Quincy Enunwa week 2. And you got Nick, who just has a sheer amount of knowledge. I mean, the guy just knows a lot about a lot. And you got Max. I mean, Max is a multi-time, multi-year, multi-league champion. And that's because he has the guts to do what other people don't do. And that's what helps him win. So it's just numbers, guys. Listening to the Sleeper Wire show is just numbers. You want to win? Listen to 12 guys who are all champions. I'm a multi-time champion myself, and I think my strongest asset is the mind game of fantasy football. If you know your enemy and you know yourself, 1,000 battles, 1,000 victories. Do you agree with this, Ian?
Well, it certainly helps to be as objective as you can be, I would imagine.
So, guys, just to get into this, now that we finished the opening, I just want to say, this is the disclaimer, I play fantasy football to win. I'm in leagues or have been in leagues where the payout is large. So I take this game pretty seriously. Now, I like the people I play with, and I made great relationships with them. But if you're in a league with your brother-in-law and you just want to have fun and not manipulate somebody, maybe this episode's not for you. But if you play to win, this is a good episode for you to listen to, because what we're going to teach you is how to persuade people and manipulate their behavior. Now, Ian, from a neuroscientist point of view, can you actually manipulate somebody to do what you want them to do without them even knowing it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's no question that, you know, the human brain or just human psychology in general is susceptible to influence. There was, for example, I was doing a literature review on deja vu, like how deja vu occurs in the brain. And it sort of took me down this winding path of learning about how sort of memory can be influenced and modified. And there were some studies that were conducted that essentially got a group of people to believe they had cheated on a test that they'd never cheated on. And just by exposing them to falsified evidence after a certain period of time and over the course of certain number of repetitions. And they got these participants, I mean, it wasn't 100%, but it was a majority of them, to basically believe that they had cheated. And then some of them even would explain how they cheated.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you know, there are definitely certain forms of sort of stimuli or stimulation that would that seem to be more effective than others.
Now, when I talk to people, I hear this a lot. I hear this one phrase a lot. You're so lucky. And in my mind, I don't think that fantasy football is a game of chance. I think it's a game of skill because it lasts so long. I think you have to have skill in this game. I used to play poker to put food on my table. And after I was playing for a while, I started noticing the same guys at the final table with me on a consistent basis. And I think fantasy football is similar to that. I think if you have skill, you will get further than if you just believe you're lucky. As far as the mind works, right? I mean, if you believe in yourself, do you tend to achieve more? Is that a real thing, or is this just the secret in some kind of, you know, psycho hippie bull?
Well, I mean, I don't know that there's necessarily a one-to-one relationship between you sort of convincing yourself of a certain outcome and that outcome coming true. I don't know that, at least I've never seen a study that suggests that's the case. But there is something to be said for using that slight illusion maybe or bias to ignore what would otherwise detract from your motivation to accomplish the goal and selectively pay attention to the evidence that suggests that you are going to be capable of succeeding. But I, you know, if that can also go the wrong way as well, right? It's sort of equally problematic.
All right. Well, guys, let's get into this. Let's get into the meat and bones of this. And I'm sure that's what people are waiting for. So let's talk about what fantasy football is, what our biases are, and how we can manipulate our opponents. You guys ready?
Sounds good.
All right.
Control.
All right. So what's the key to success in fantasy football? I mean, ultimately, our season boils down to a series of choices. The transfers we make, the players we bench, the quality of our choices determines our points. At least that's the theory. But your decisions are subject to cognitive biases, which are what?
Well, I mean, they essentially emerge from the fact that the human brain and human psychology is not perfectly skeptical and it's not perfectly objective. You are influenced by your past experiences, by your worldview, by the environment in which you were raised, and absolutely by the genetics you've inherited from your parents. And so all of these things will result in behavioral predispositions. And so these can be predispositions to becoming addicted to a drug or quite likely to making one choice over another.
So, and I think this is a good example because I know everybody listening, this has happened to you. You watched one of your stud players play like shit 1 week. So you benched him. And what did he do next week? He just went off on your bench, right? That's a bias, right? You see something and it does not necessarily – past performance doesn't necessarily reflect future performance in this case. So that would be considered a bias, correct, Ian?
It would be, right, where you are sort of expecting – you believe that a future outcome is certain based off of past experience, but that level of certainty isn't really justified. At least it isn't as justified as you believe it to be.
When it comes to gambling, it's called the gambler's fallacy. Like if yes. You're playing a game where you get, you know, like you win if tails comes up, like flipping a coin, you win if it's tails, and there's been 50 heads in a row, you think the gambler's fallacy is, okay, well, the next one's got to be tails because we've had 50 heads. But the probability doesn't change. It's still a 50-50 chance.
Each time, right.
Each time, right.
Now, if you were looking at the beginning, what's the probability that I will get 50 in a row? Then it changes. But the gambler's fallacy is that what happened in the past is not going to affect what happens next.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you talked about one of the biases because I want to talk about the four most common that I think are in fantasy football players. And I want to start off with this confirmation bias. Ian, what's a confirmation bias?
Right. So basically, it's when your desire for a particular outcome kind of like puts a thumb on the scales. And so this is a really common bias in everything from politics to your personal life. And so like basically what you do is only, we kind of talked about it, you only concern yourself with evidence or facts that confirm your views. And then you just ignore or maybe trivialize facts that might contradict them. And so there's kind of a phrase, I can't remember where it came from, but the phrase is, we are prisoners of our own assumption. And there's a bunch of great political debates that are great examples of this. But in a nutshell, that's what this is.
So, Chris, we were in a league.
You know, using a statistical approach is probably among the more powerful approaches, right? Particularly, you know, when you think of the data that you have at your disposal. But of course, every now and then, it's going to fail you, right? And so in this particular unique case, you know, it perhaps, you know, that's an example.
Trying to do. I want you guys to understand these biases because we're going to come back. Now we have to figure out kind of why people do the things they do before we figure out how to change them. So another one is the endowment effect. What is the endowment effect, Ian?
So yeah, this is another kind of bias, and it's actually a pretty understandable one. It's like it's one that's probably more common than it might sound. And so basically, it's the fact that we tend to place a higher value on things that we personally have than what other people or maybe just like the market for that thing would typically value. And so like, you know, in my mind, when I think of the endowment effect, I think of the first guitar I ever owned, which was the Fender Squire. And for anybody that doesn't know guitar brands, Fender is like a classic American brand. Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, Stevie Ray Vaughan all played Fender guitars. They played Stratocasters. Right. So Fender Stratocasters. I had a Fender Squire, bargain level. Right. And once I started getting a little bit more serious about the guitar, I wanted to get a nicer guitar. And so what would make sense would be for me to sell it. Right. But nobody was going to buy my Fender Squire at the price that I wanted. Right. Because it's kind of a piece of crap. And so I ended up just giving it away to somebody that, you know, I had a, you know, personal affection for. But the smarter thing would have been to just sell it for whatever I could get. And then make my next guitar a little bit cheaper. And so it basically revolves around the fact that, you know, as humans, we form attachments, with the people and things around us in our environment. And so just like you personally value your own home, for example, over the homes of others, you'll tend to do that with pretty much everything else.
I run my own real estate company, and that's certainly the truth. When we try to sell people's homes and we tell them what it's worth, they don't always believe it. You have to come in with some pretty hard data.
Right.
So the third one that I want to talk about kind of is the omission bias. What is that?
Okay. Yeah. So broadly speaking, this describes the fact that doing nothing tends to be viewed as less damaging or maybe less culpable than actively doing something. And so we tend to rank the damage caused by inaction as less severe than the damage caused by action. And so just imagine that you're back playing like high school football, if you played high school football, and for some reason the opposing team comes to your school to eat lunch at your cafeteria before the game, right? You know that they have a star quarterback, and if he can't perform, your team is probably going to beat them. And you hear that one of your teammates is talking about maybe slipping a ton of laxatives into his food, which is a crime, by the way, and you can totally go to prison for that. And so what do you think is a worse crime to have committed? If you know that one of your teammates is going to or did slip laxatives into the opposing quarterback's drink and you do nothing about it, or is it worse if you yourself slip the laxatives into his drink? And so we tend to have a tendency to consider the person who actually snuck the laxatives in the drink as the guiltier person than the people who knew about it but did nothing to stop it.
So, for example, like picking up Jay Cutler last season was disastrous, but we really didn't care that we passed up on Aaron Rodgers for Cam Newton, right?
Well, when it came to the draft, we didn't.
When it came to the draft, we didn't, right?
Right.
After the season progressed, we certainly did.
Yes, after about 4 weeks. Oh, wait.
All right, and the last bias I want to talk about is the pseudo-certainty effect. And I think this really relates to fantasy football players. What is the pseudo-certainty effect?
Yeah, so this is a little bit more esoteric. And so this is some research that sort of began a couple decades ago, but the term, as the term kind of suggests, right, pseudo-certainty, that this is a bias that describes our tendency to perceive an outcome as certain, even though it isn't. We kind of talked about this a little bit earlier, but it basically describes the fact that we'll tend to emphasize outcomes that we perceive as certain to occur and de-emphasize those that are perhaps just as likely, but we just don't perceive them as certain to occur. And we can talk about some examples if you want, but that's broadly speaking what's going on.
So it's the idea of taking fewer risks when you're confident of success and more risks when you're not.
That can be part of it. And maybe like an easier way to understand this is like, imagine a person who has cancer, not to bring up a super dark thing, and there's two treatment strategies available. And this isn't too irregular. So one strategy is to use a standard of care, like a standard chemotherapeutic agent that's used for this particular type of cancer, and it'll typically extend the life of somebody for a predictable period of time, like maybe another, 18 years or so. And it has known side effects, but it's unlikely to be fatal itself. The other strategy is to enroll in a clinical trial for an experimental treatment that has the possibility of enabling somebody to live another 40 years. Right, but might have some very problematic side effects or even death that, this isn't yet known. So in other words, the patient can be reasonably certain that they might live for another almost 20 years or so with one treatment with predictably bad, but not like fatal side effects. But there's also the possibility that they might live a completely normal life and live considerably longer, but it's just much less certain how likely that's to come, how likely that's to occur.
So I can think about a fantasy football comparison because when I was coming up with this one made sense to me. In fantasy football, if you were 3-9 and you needed to win the rest of your games to get into the playoffs, would you have traded a player like Ty Montgomery or would you play a player like Ty Montgomery if you had him knowing that he's up and down and you're just not sure what he's going to do? You probably would because you would need to take the risk hoping that he does better. But on the opposite side, if you were 9-3 and guaranteed a playoff spot, maybe you would play Matt Jones over Ty Montgomery because he's the more steady player. That's the way I see it as far
right,
yeah, as
so,
what it is.
So right, if you have nothing to lose, I kind of see what you mean. Then you're more likely to do the equivalent of like a Hail Mary and take a big risk for a potential huge payout.
So then my question is, how does all this affect Tom Brady? Because he doesn't seem to be affected by any of
Cheater. Sorry, I had to sneeze.
So listeners, I'm hoping that you can see how knowing what biases are and why people do what they do is important. We need to understand the why before we change the action. And that's what I want to get into now, man. I want to get into how do we change the action. This is really the part where I think we can have some good discussions, because I want to know if these manipulation techniques will work, if they won't. So before we do this, you guys want to try another mind game real fast?
I'm game.
All right, here we go. I want you to say the word that I spell out for you. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
S-H-O-P.
Shop.
What do you do when you come to a green light?
Stop.
Yes!
You got me.
All right. So, the first manipulation technique that we're going to talk about is called the fear and relief technique. Now, what is this and how can we use it to change our opponent's choices? And how can we use the biases that we talked about in order to make this even more effective?
It kind of emerges from an effort to manipulate sort of survival circuitry in the brain. And so it describes a behavioral response where a person who's experiencing anxiety or fear due to some specific stimulus. And once that stimulus is rapidly removed, once there's no more reason for that person to be anxious or fearful, that person will tend to be somewhat more pliable and compliant. And I've seen it described as the following. So basically, when someone is in fear, they begin to engage in certain expectations and plans as a result of that fear. But once that fear is eliminated, the cause of that fear is eliminated, the person hasn't really been expecting to be without that source of fear. And so they haven't engaged in a new plan. And so they're perhaps more susceptible to being influenced.
So would the fear relief technique be more about people's emotion than logic? Would you say does it say that people are more emotionally driven than logic driven? Is that what the fear and relief technique is? Or is it that people act in a way that's uncharacteristic when they're afraid?
Well, you know what? That's a really important point. So a study that was published earlier this year suggests that different people respond to this kind of social influence in different ways. And the study seems to suggest that there are different susceptibilities to this kind of a response. And so in particular, they'll highlight the people with a high need for what they call cognitive closure, were particularly sensitive to this kind of treatment. And so cognitive closure, it just basically means closure. It just means that, you know, they understand a given, you know, concern. And
so one idea that I had was this Ratzenberger's pivot. Have you heard of this?
I haven't.
Okay. So this is an idea that I came across when I was doing some research. And the idea is that you quiet down when somebody is upset and you listen to their objections. Once you've heard them, you use the things they said to find a common ground that gives you something to grow on. Then what you do after you find that common ground is start giving people a reason using the common ground to do something. And it doesn't even need to be a good reason. As long as you give somebody a reason, they will be more likely to do it because that's simply how our mind works. Is that true or is this crazy?
It's definitely devious.
Again, I'm not saying you guys should break the rules. I'm just saying they can be bent a little.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I haven't seen any studies that try and quantify the success of something like this. I've only seen studies that try and quantify whether or not, you know, people are even susceptible to this kind of treatment. But, you know, I would suppose that the researchers of the studies that I've seen would probably agree. But, you know, I can't frankly speak for them.
Sure. All right. Let me give you an example, a fantasy football example. And Chris, maybe you could speak to this and tell me if this could be realistic, because I think it is. Let's say you're making a trade with your opponent and you want to trade your T.Y. Hilton for his Zeke. All right. He tells you that's preposterous. Everybody knows Zeke is the better running back. Running backs are way more valuable than wide receivers. I'm never going to trade that with you. So if you're using the Ratzenberger's pivot, so now instead of T.Y. Hilton, you can offer him maybe like Adrian Peterson, Latavius Murray, Alvin Kamara. And your reason is that two or three running backs are better than one wide receiver. And you've already built this common ground with him. So he's going to feel like accepting that trade was his idea. And you get what you want, which is Zeke. Now, I'm not saying this will always work, but the point is, every time your opponent speaks, there's an opportunity to exploit.
Yeah, this can happen even if you're just in like a league with people who you don't really know. Maybe it's, you know, like you're part of a Facebook page or something like that, and you're like, hey, let's have a fantasy football league between the members of this Facebook page. You start throwing out trade offers and everything, and then you learn, you know, what position each player kind of values. And then you can start using that to your advantage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ian, what's priming?
Priming. Okay, so that's essentially what you got me to do there before we started this segment. It's when essentially you plant the seed of an idea or an image or whatever without necessarily explicitly telling somebody to think of it. And so I actually did this with my class of undergrads, where we were studying memory, and we were studying the one brain region that's classically associated with memory is the hippocampus, right? Even people who don't even study the brain recognize that term. And you know, I didn't mention that part of the brain at all during the presentation, not one time. And then, but I did keep using pictures of animals as like in my examples of how, you know, neurons work and stuff like that. And then at the end, I gave them a slide with, you know, letters and spaces to fill in. And the vast majority of them, and I say it was like H space, you know, PP space like this, you know. And then I asked them to give me some examples. And the vast majority said hippopotamus. And of course, you know, or it was the hippocampus would have made the most sense, right?
Sure.
And so, yeah, it's just that kind of subtle, you know, predisposing somebody to think of one thing rather than another.
And you can use that, right? When you're trying to get somebody to do something that you want, you can certainly use priming by setting things up. Chris, any ideas on how we could use priming in fantasy football?
No idea you were going to ask me this question. You want a certain wide receiver. You start talking about all these running backs that you think are great. That could get in your opponent's head, hey, this guy really likes running backs. Maybe I should take one before he takes them all. So, you know, the next few people draft a running back, then you get the wide receiver that you wanted.
Right. And I like this phrase you use, get into your opponent's head. I hear that all the time, right? And when people say it, it's not the same as manipulate your opponent to do what you want. Or is it? It
has a little less stank on it.
Yeah, right. Having control is a manipulation technique in itself, isn't it, Ian?
Well, I mean, I would imagine. Yeah, I've never been in so competitive a situation. I would certainly prefer to have control than a lack thereof.
Does being the commissioner, the head of the league, the person in control, give you an advantage? And this is for you, Chris, because I think you've been a commissioner before.
Yeah, I have. I've also dealt with a cheating commissioner who did change the rules, and I completely agree that they are assholes. But I think being the commissioner of a league does kind of give you an advantage, more so when it comes to trades. And people sort of view trades as something that, okay, this, you know, this is, I'm going to win the trade. This is going to work for me. I don't really, there are people who try to, you know, be Mr. Nice Guy when it comes to fantasy football and say, oh, this is going to help both of us out. No, screw that. I want to win the trade. And that's how I've always viewed it. But, you know, if it's just two people who aren't the commissioner and you're throwing out this trade offer, people are going to – they're more along the lines of thinking, okay, well, he's lowballing me. I need to counter with something that's going to benefit me even more. But if you're the commissioner, there's this sort of feel about how you're the fair one. Because there are some leagues where being the commissioner is the deciding factor. The commissioner has to approve trades. Well, if the commissioner is one of the ones making a trade, maybe your league mates could see that as, okay, well, it's a little bit more fair since the commissioner wants to do this, rather than if it was just some other random person in the league and you're, you know, oh, this guy's just lowballing me, you know, screw him, I'm just not gonna, you know, I'm not even gonna respond to this, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And these may not be big things that we're talking about, but we're talking about we're talking about a game that's played over the course of like 4 months for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So even the slightest nudge that you can get your opponent to do may shift him off into a direction that really helps you out in the long run. I mean, we're going to be part of the Scott Fishbowl, and that has how many 400 and something participants? I mean, it's crazy. We need every advantage we can get.
Oh, and I'll give you an example of one of the trades I made in a league I commissioned last year, and it's a keeper league. It was the first year of a keeper league. We keep three players, or up to three players. So you can keep 0, 1, 2, or 3. And in this particular league, I had drafted Brandon Marshall, and we know he wasn't doing very well. I hadn't drafted Marshall. I was trying to trade for Brandon Marshall, so I had, I think, Arian Foster before he, you know, just up and retired. And Brandon Marshall was doing awful. I went to this guy. I said, hey, I'll give you Arian Foster in my 13th for Brandon Marshall, who was horrible, and your fourth-round pick next year. And I think he was thinking, oh, a fourth round, you know, that's the fourth round. That's not really going to matter. Well, it's a three-keeper league, so the fourth round is the first round. And because that's the way it's set up, that your first, your three keepers are your first three round picks. And we've already set the draft order because it goes in, you know, inverse order of who finished. He has the number one draft pick, or had, which means I have the number one draft pick. And I think it just, it worked out in my favor because being the commissioner, he viewed it as a little bit more fair. Or maybe, you know, he just might not have known what he was doing as well. I wouldn't like to think that someone just gets completely taken advantage of. But I'm not sure that trade would have been made with just some random person who's not the commissioner.
Let me give you guys an example of something. And I think you'll understand what I'm getting at, Ian, as soon as I get into it. Let's say you need a good quarterback. Well, there's tons of information out there, good and bad, for all the quarterbacks playing right now. So if you can keep the negative information about your opponent's quarterback in their mind, you can possibly start chipping away at their confidence in that player, and you'll find it easier for them to get. And this, what I'm trying to get at here is what's become incredibly popular with alternative facts, manipulation of facts, and overwhelming people with statistics. And I know that you're especially interested in this, Ian, so I want to really dive into this. How can we, what is this and how can we use it?
Right. I mean, and I'm sure I'm not the only person, you know, who's in this conversation that has this sort of pet peeve of correlation doesn't equal causation in statistics. But like a classic way or a classic version of misusing data or stats to sort of manipulate a perspective is to report just an average value, just some average, but not report how much variation in the sort of outcomes there are. Just for example, let's say you have a room full of 20 drunk people, right? Right.
We're here right now.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you know, you give them all unlimited chances to hit the bullseye. And you get an average of how many times, how many tries it took to ultimately hit the bullseye. And let's say the average turned out to be around 20 times, right? You then say, hey, you know, 20 times, right? It looks like alcohol doesn't have too huge an effect on dart throwing. Like, you know, I probably couldn't hit a bullseye that many times. I don't know. And so maybe alcohol doesn't actually inebriate us as much as we feel like it does. But then, you know, when you say that it takes an average of 20 tries to hit a bullseye when drunk, you start thinking like, okay, so some people probably took a bit more, maybe a bit less. Some hit it in 15, some in maybe, I don't know, 25. But it could easily have been, you know, the range could have been much, much greater, right? Where it could have been, some people took 40 hits and some people took 10 tries to hit the bullseye. And while you still end up at that average value, it doesn't really report the fact that, you know, it could potentially take you much, much more than 20 tries or much less. And so you deliver this picture of performance that's actually unrepresentative of the reality.
Well, fantasy football is a game of statistics. I mean, it is a game of numbers, much like poker is, right? So how can you manipulate that data into telling you something that's not there? Or is that what's happening in all of these games that we're playing? Is data being manipulated in a covert and a deceitful way?
Well, I mean, I don't know necessarily. I mean, I'm sure some people do that, right? But you know, it's, statistics are our best effort, you know, when done correctly, our best effort to evaluate data objectively. But different questions are most appropriately approached with different statistical values or statistical, you know, hypotheses, tests. And so you can sort of pick the test, an average or a median, that most represents the interpretation that you want to deliver, right? And this happens by mistake sometimes in science. So for example, you know, there's the classic correlation doesn't equal causation, you know, issue. There's this one example that I just brought up at a talk recently. And so there's been a 17% growth in the population of panda bears over the past decade, right? And that's great. The number,
right? Everybody loves panda bears.
Yeah. But then also the number of opiate addicts in the United States has increased very significantly over the past decade as well. So in 2015, over twice as many people died of opiate-related overdoses than did in 2007, right? And so, you know, one could conclude that we obviously need to stop breeding so many panda bears if we have any hope of slowing the rate of opiate addiction. Right, but of course, it's totally absurd.
Yeah, we do. In one of the night classes I teach for a local community college here in Indiana, we talk about, you know, we have a statistics section and we bring up correlation. And I, you know, you try to emphasize as much as you can that correlation doesn't cause, correlation does not imply causation. And the example I always use is that ice cream sales and shark attacks are positively correlated.
Yeah.
Because yeah, right, summer, more people buy ice cream, more people go to the beach. There's a better, you know, statistically speaking, a better chance for someone to get attacked by a shark when there's more people at the beach. There's more opportunity. But does that mean that eating ice cream causes sharks to attack more? No, of course not.
Exactly. And you know, because we evolved to be pattern seeking, you know, to see patterns in nature to, you know, promote our own survival, we're very susceptible to those kinds of misunderstandings.
So... Yep. How can we use this in fantasy football is my ultimate question here, if that's what we're talking about. How do we use this to win? How do we use data like this to win? If we were to tell somebody that, how can we use patterns like this and statistics in order to convince our opponents that their player either is not as good as he says he is, or our player is better? This sounds like something possible to do. And I have a mathematics professor and a neuroscientist on the show to tell me how to do this.
I can give you a great example. I was actually, you know, one of the things that we do here, our most popular show is The Great Debate. And Ian, for just so you know, and for our listeners who may be listening for the first time, what The Great Debate is that it's me and Adam. I'll pick a player, and then Adam will pick a player, and then it'll be like a debate-style argument. So I'll get 2 minutes to argue for my guy, using all the stats and everything I can, then he'll get a minute to argue against him. So a 1 minute rebuttal, then we'll flip. He gets 2 minutes for his guy. I get 1 minute for a rebuttal. And then we wrap it up with final thoughts on our player. That's a perfect place to sort of point out, hey, you were actually wrong on this because you said this stat, but when you break it down, this is actually what it is. I was talking with a guy on Sleeperbot, and hopefully he'll listen to the show because, you know, he's pretty active on there. We've done some mock drafts together. But he was talking about how Spencer Ware, you know, being drafted like after the fifth round and everything is just ridiculous. He needs to be drafted way earlier because, you know, the guy put up over 1,300 total yards last year. And he finished as an RB2, so, well, you know, like, he's really good, so you need to start drafting him in, like, the third round. That's where I'm going to take him, blah, blah, blah. But then I look at it, it's like, oh, yeah, 1,300 total yards, more than that, sounds pretty good if you average that out. Like, he missed a game or two, so it's pretty decent average if you were to go per game. But then I started looking into it. After week 7, he never topped 70 rushing yards, and he never had over 100 total yards in a game after week 7. So he's trying to say, oh, this guy's so great. Look at what he did here. You know, this whole season was good. He had this many touchdowns, this many yards. But when you break it down, yeah, but half that was in the first 7 games.
I'm glad you brought up The Great Debates, man, because that's just one of the 5 shows that we do every week during the season. So you'll have Sleeper Wire every day to break down every position, to break down every player that's in the top 25. And our rankings last season were some of the most accurate. But let's move on, because I know people want to get to the one that's 100%. So the second to last one is hypocrisy. Why do people hate being hypocrites, and what is a hypocrite? Ian?
You know, it's funny. I don't know that people actually hate hypocrites. I think we assume that they do. But other priorities probably take precedence, or take priority. But fundamentally, it's, you know, you develop a perspective on somebody. You know, humans by nature like sort of predictability. We always want to minimize uncertainty. In fact, part of what happens when we're asleep is automatic brain activity in response to something that might have been surprising in the day previous or the previous day. so that if that ever happens again, it'll be less surprising. And so I think that, you know, when it comes to hypocrisy, when somebody presents themselves as a certain type of person who's going to behave in a certain type of way and they directly contradict that, it's sort of shocking to that perspective and fundamentally repulsive.
Well, from what I understand, not from what I understand, from what I know of myself, if somebody called me out and said, "You're a hypocrite," it would give me pause. I would have to stop, back up, and take a look at myself, even more so than if somebody said, "You're stupid," or "You're not cool," right? Those things don't matter. Hypocrite seems to be a stronger word. And I think we as people give words value, but maybe that's just, and this might be for another day, next time you come on, but maybe some people give words more value than others.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And I mean, you know, I think that perhaps we use hypocrisy as a placeholder for other things. Like loyalty, maybe, or follow through, right? You know, we put a lot of things in the bucket of hypocrisy, but fundamentally, I think it's just the fact that we expected you to do one thing and you did another, and you know, you're not being honest.
Let me give an example. If you can get someone in your league who hates, let's say, the Patriots,
as every self-respecting person should.
and you see they have Tom Brady on their team. Well, that again gives you an advantage, right? Because you know that they hate the Patriots. You could publicly point out their hypocrisy. And 2 weeks later, try to make a trade privately. Now, that's not breaking the rules. That's just bending them a little. So, and I think what this does is it switches people from being rational to being emotional. And we talked about this a little bit before, but I think this is a really important subject to talk about. What happens to your brain when you switch from being logical and rational to emotional?
That's an interesting topic. I totally didn't expect this to come up. but yeah, there are sort of predispositions to thinking in certain ways that people will tend to have. So for example, some folks will tend to be predisposed to relying more on analysis, being a bit more pragmatic to solve problems. And some folks will tend to rely more on sort of moments of insight or just sort of thinking on the fly. Maybe, you know, we might call that a more creative approach, perhaps. And it turns out that somebody who's more anxious, who just tends to be prone to, you know, worry about what might happen, they tend to be a lot more analytical. They tend to not be as sort of relaxed and open to new information. They tend to sort of define the problem and sort of withdraw and focus on what they know. And so, I mean, there's something to be said for somebody who is susceptible to being shamed by hypocrisy. Shame and disgust are extraordinarily powerful motivating factors. There are even some addiction medicine specialists who suggest that in the absence of any sort of shame or disgust at one's own decision-making, recovery from addiction is very, very difficult. And so these are very primitive parts of the brain that are associated with disgust. We're talking like the insular cortex for anybody that's actually interested in that. But yeah, they are extremely powerful motivating factors, because ultimately what they're doing is tapping into, you know, again, survival associated circuitry.
And a lot of my understanding of our choices as people is based off evolutionary process. We do a lot of things just based off of years and years of it being coded into our DNA to survive. And I want to get to that when we get to the next topic. But before I do, I want you guys to do a favor for me. All right? I want you guys to yell out at the top of your lung, out for Harambe. No. I'm just kidding. What I want you to do is I want you to tell our audience what the next topic is, and that's simply repeat after me, ask for a favor.
Ask for a favor.
Can I go back and say one thing about the previous?
As soon as you do the other thing. No, I actually, I'm glad you did that, but cool.
I went to a Halloween party last year, and the whole Harambe thing happened in what, like April-ish? You know, early last year. And it Halloween party at a friend's house, and they always have like, they have a little costume contest, and they have like scariest costume, most original, and then current events. Well, I, you know, I'm cheap. I didn't want to go spend the money on a costume, so I just had a plain white t-shirt that I drew, a like just the outline of a silhouette of a gorilla that I found on Google and wrote dicks out on it. I won current events costume.
Wow.
$10 Subway gift card. Anyways, what I was going back to that technique is that the best way to approach that is with someone that you know is a homer for their team. I'm in a Facebook on a Facebook page that's up all about the AFC South. So, you know, we got the Colts, the Texans, the Titans, and the Jaguars. That's one of the leagues. It's a 10-person league with, you know, just some guys who are from that Facebook page. Well, a couple of the Jags fans want every single Jaguar on their team. They drafted Allen Robinson super high. They drafted Allen Hurns, so on and so forth. They got Blake Bortles, you know, super early, like in the fourth round. I made sure to draft TJ Yeldon late, and the reason for that is not because I wanted TJ Yeldon, but because I knew they would want TJ Yeldon. So I was going to be able to flip him for a player that I liked more, because, you know, you're never ever going to play TJ Yeldon. He's not going to be someone that you put in your lineup. He's someone that, you know, should probably be on the waiver wire, but he's a starting running back, so you're not going to drop him, but you're never going to play him. People who you know are just huge fans of their team, you can make trades with them and get more value for a player because they value a player a little bit more.
That's so funny. It's like tribal loyalty almost.
And it is. And that's good because we have team loyalty. I was watching this Brain Game show in preparation for this, and they were talking about, oh gosh, what was it? The competitive brain, and how, and there was a something versus something that happens in your competitive brain. If you just tell somebody either be part of the blue team or be part of the red team, if you associate yourself with that team and that team wins or loses, it actually releases chemicals into your brain that stimulate you. And this happens on a mass level with football.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, absolutely. We are super prone. We're very social organisms, right? I mean, if you isolate a human, it's very damaging psychologically. And there are a ton of what might be considered unethical experiments that were conducted where you can get people to believe pretty ridiculous things about themselves by just telling people that, you know, you are, you know, everybody with brown hair is smarter than everybody with blonde hair. And, you know, over
blue
time,
eyes,
they'll just
brown eyes.
Yeah. You remember that experiment?
Yeah. I was a teacher for 10 years. I absolutely remember that experiment.
There you go. Yeah. Imagine somebody trying to conduct that experiment now.
Oh, geez. You'd be in jail. You'd go to jail.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many examples of experiments like that. But yeah, I mean, clearly we are very prone to like tribal groupthink.
Or Milton's or the Stanford experiment.
There you go.
Both of
them.
I mean, yeah, those are all really, really interesting of what you could do. So the technique that's 100% successful. Actually, I am glad that you fell for it, Ian. Chris, I've known you too long, and I did not expect you to yell. but the method that's 100% successful is simply doing what Ian said. You ask for a favor, but you don't just ask for one. You ask for two. And what you do is you make sure that the first favor has higher value and meaning than what you really want. That request, like Ian said, would almost certainly be refused. When I asked Ian to say, Zombie, he went, you first, right? He's not going to do that. He doesn't know me. But when I asked him to just repeat for me, ask for a favor, he did it because that favor is smaller than the one I originally asked for. But it's the favor that I wanted. So this, statistically speaking, has almost a 100% success ratio. Really, the only time it doesn't is when the person's made up their mind they're not going to do it or they can't do it. People will tend to say yes to the smaller second favor which should be your initial favor at the beginning. And why does this work so often? I mean, I work in business and I see this work all the time, and I don't understand why.
That's classic, right? It's called anchoring, right? When you anchor a negotiation, you high ball, low ball, whatever it might be. And then the, perceived opportunity cost, relative to the initial offer is significantly lower, right? And so you've already anchored the discussion at such a radical position that anything that's less radical is more appetizing.
And people, and like we were saying, this is an evolutionary process, and we had to trust each other in order to survive, right? So when you start asking people for a favor and they say no, isn't there a psychological aspect to saying no to somebody that makes you want to say yes to them?
Certainly to somebody, with whom you have a relationship of some sort. When you ask me for, for the second ask, right? And you just went silent. I could have just continued to sit there like an asshole and just been silent, but, you invited me on your podcast, you're being very, welcoming, and what am I going to do? these are just social, this is part of the social contract, right? Where, as little as we know each other, we have developed a relationship at this point, right? And so if I were to just continue being obstinate and just refuse to acquiesce to anything you ask for, yeah, I'd feel pretty ashamed.
and the show that got me really thinking about this is Brain Games. And there was a particular episode that started the way this one started, but had this game in it. And the game had a briefcase full of money. And it was only they had a briefcase full of money, and they had two cards, either share or steal. And if they chose share, and both of them chose share, they'd split the money. But if one of them chose steal, that person would get all the money. And if both of them chose steal, neither of them would get the money. And overwhelmingly, people chose share together. Why is this come back to our evolutionary process, or is there something in the brain that just wants us to work well with others?
So that's a classic experiment. So there's, an economics experiment, but there is a sort of blossoming field within neuroscience called neuroeconomics. And it's still a pretty, young field. And so there's not a lot of great science in it quite yet. But there are some sort of landmark experiments that were performed by a guy named Paul Zak out in Claremont, California. And so you might have heard of the neurotransmitter. It's actually a neuropeptide called oxytocin. And so it turns out that if you administer oxytocin to a person, they tend to be considerably more trusting and more social in general. This is the same neuropeptide that's released when, you're young or when you're, with your loved ones, right? It's the same neuropeptide, but this neuropeptide also seems to be involved in promoting sort of pro-social activity. It's been a little bit trivialized. People try and be a little bit too simplistic about it. Those types of interactions, where I trust that you are also going to share it with me, that is sensitive to these, evolutionarily ancient neurotransmitters that exist not only in humans, but in basically any organism that's capable of forming sort of longer term relationships. I mean, there are even like voles, which are basically like moles. And so, it turns out that voles that actually have this neurotransmitter, oxytocin, are capable of pair bonding, or what we would probably call love. Whereas other voles that don't have oxytocin, they just don't express it. They don't. These types of social interactions are very sensitive to these, evolutionarily ancient signals.
Chris, I'm going to put you on the spot again. From a fantasy football perspective, how do we use these types of techniques, these types of trust? We want to be social. People want to trust other people. How could we use this to our advantage in a fantasy football season with others?
Well, if you want people to trust you in the future, I think maybe the best way to go about that is by making some small trades early on that aren't necessarily going to hurt you, but the other person could perceive as a win.
Good. It builds up trust. I like that.
It builds up trust. Yes. They're going to think, oh, well, this, you know, I won trades with this guy before. Maybe, you know, he's going to be super easy to trade with. I'm going to keep trading with him. And then, you know, you can maybe work it so that in week 8, you are winning the trade by a lot.
Right. And what you could do is you could go for something really big that they're going to refuse. But because you've already built up that trust, then when you come with something smaller, which is originally what you wanted, you'll get it. Or you could use hypocrisy or fear and relief with these. I mean, these aren't standalone techniques. If you can use them all.
One of the examples that I was just thinking of, actually, while Ian was talking, is you say you need a running back. You want Isaiah Crowell. He's been killing it. You know, he's a great RB2. He can put up RB1 numbers. You know, I want Isaiah Crowell. The guy who has him also has David Johnson. So maybe you throw out something like, hey, I'm going to give you Jordy Nelson. He's having a great year. He's a clear wide receiver one. I'll give you Jordy Nelson for David Johnson. And the guy's going to be like, you know, you. He's the number one player in fantasy football. I'm not going to do that. He's like, okay, well, you know, well, what about Isaiah Crowell? What can I give you for Isaiah Crowell? And then he's going to be like, okay, well, he doesn't want my number one best player. He's wanting a step down from that. Okay, now maybe I can talk with him.
Right. And again, we're not saying this is going to work for everybody for in all your leagues, but we're talking about a season-long way of winning, and that's what we do on Sleeper Wire. We win games. So that's why we're talking about this. But really, I just want to summarize the things that we talked about, because what we covered quite a bit in this episode, I think. Right, guys?
Yeah, well, I know that I'm glad I'm not in a league with you guys.
So just to summarize, man, why people do what they do? Well, they do it because of a confirmation bias. They do it because of omission bias, pseudo-certainty effect, recency effect. I mean, there's tons of different reasons. And if we know why the person is trading, drafting, or positioning themselves in such a way, and we know their personality enough to detect a weakness, we can exploit it using the fear and relief technique, hypocrisy, favors, manipulation of facts. So these are all ways in order to help you win your league. And if this technique is not for you, that's great. We've got 11 other techniques at Sleeper Wire that we're going to cover as we get closer to the season. So is there anything that we missed? And Ian, I'm going to have you on the show again. and you know what? I should have started that with Ian. I want you on the show every day because that would have been the bigger favor. And then I would just ask for the smaller favor, which is I would love to have you on the show again at some point in the future if you would be accommodating. It doesn't have to be anytime soon, but certainly you've been awesome.
Well, anytime that I can offer any insight, then I'm happy to.
Great. And can you tell our listeners, you know, where they can find you, where they can follow you? And I know they you're not going to be giving them fantasy football advice, but maybe they'll be reaching out saying, hey, my opponent said this to me. How should I respond? So,
well, I'm probably not the best coach when it comes to like practical implementation. I would imagine you guys are probably the best coaches there, but yeah, I mean, so I've been talking about the brain on sort of social media, for about a year and a half now. And I've been primarily using Periscope and Twitter, Periscope is Twitter's sort of live video streaming platform. Mm-hmm. And, my handle there is @_anthropoid. And so that's probably
spell that.
Yeah. Right. It's ANTHROPOID, anthropoid, with a little underscore before that. And, that's probably the easiest way to get in touch. I have a website and it's anthropoid.science instead of .com. And then I have my own little podcast called Wired to Be Weird, and we cover topics from deja vu or how dreams occur to what psychosis and schizophrenia are, what we understand about addiction or Alzheimer's or dementia and a bunch I'm probably forgetting. And that's available on iTunes and Stitcher and Overcast and a bunch of other platforms that I'm forgetting.
and you're a handsome guy.
Yeah, yeah, you're much better looking than Chris, that's for sure. Hey, Chris, can you tell the listeners where they can find the Sleeper Wire show? I mean, we're everywhere.
Yeah, we are in a lot of places. You can follow us on Twitter at Sleeper Wire Show. We've got a great social media guy who's on there, always doing really cool stuff with our Twitter. You can find me on the Sleeperbot app, and I'm on there at Professor Chris. Adam runs our Sleeper Wire account on Sleeperbot, so that's how you can find him. You can also go to our website, sleeperwire.com. During the season, we have our rankings updated every single week. We post our podcasts there. All that good stuff. We're going to have articles. You know, it's going to be great this season.
Awesome. Awesome. And to finish this off, we need to tell the listeners why we do this. Why do we do what we're doing, Chris?
Well, we do all of this for our good friend Rob, who's been struggling for almost his entire life with chronic Lyme disease. His medical bills are pretty outrageous. Everything that we do is for him. We are, completely, as of right now, I don't think we can say we're an official charity.
We will be by the season, and anything you make out to Sleeper Wire during the season will be tax write-off for sure.
Even better. But yeah, so we do all of this for him. Every single donation that comes in to us all goes towards him. We don't keep a penny of it. None of it goes towards us. We're not making money and trying to scam you guys or anything. So if you have it in your heart, go to his GoFundMe page, GoFundMe.com/RobJR, put in a couple bucks. I'm sure he would be very, very much appreciative of that.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Adam, Chris, thanks all for listening. Good night. All right. And I should have played that before. But that's okay. I got one more thing I want to play. This is funny. I want you guys to hear it.
So, 4D. Think of a country starting with that letter. What country starts with a D? Denmark. Okay, and think of an animal starting with the last letter of that country. Okay, Denmark, that's a K. I honestly go to kangaroo. Because it already has the K, so it just makes me want to say kangaroo. Think of a color starting with the last letter of the animal. I'll say like a brown. Probably brown or orange. Thinking more like orange. Okay, let's see if it got it. Orange kangaroo in Denmark. What the fuck? There's no fucking way. Oh my god, there's no way. This shit is rigged, bro. No, I can't believe this. Guys, I'm actually shocked. How is that possible? Yo, is there cameras here? Yo. Yo. Is there someone watching me? Yo. Orange kangaroo in Denmark. That is unbelievable.
All right. So
to be
that's
fair, I did think about a koala.
Dude, I did the same thing.
You know what? Here's the thing. I got you all the way down to the K.
Yeah, and that's good.
And a majority of people will think of orange kangaroo. The reason why this works is because –